All right. So right now, I am joined with Stan Goff, who is a now he's a author and an activist, but in a past life he was served in the United States Delta Force in the United States Special Forces. So thank you very much for joining me, Stan. Today is the occasion. I mean, this interview will air on November 11th, which is the occasion of Remembrance Day or Veterans Day in the United States. And there's a lot of these sort of media depictions of soldiers' life and what that entails. But first, what I kind of want to dive into a little bit is your own experience in the military. And when did you first join the military, and why did you join?
Kind of wandered around aimlessly, and ended up joining the Army, and then went pretty much from there straight to Vietnam, which is another thing that's almost like ancient history for a lot of people now. But I stayed in the first time just 3 years. Then I reverted to reserve status for another 3 years, and then another year and a half after that it expired. I went back in. The second time I went back in for economic reasons. I had an infant daughter and was in trouble financially and needed a steady job, so I went back to something that I knew. The first time that I joined, I mean, people have to understand it was in the context of the Cold War, and I'd been raised in a very conservative family, and the world is sort of seen in terms of us and them, and the idea that you were stopping some sort of a communist world threat was something that we actually were taught in school. The John Birch Society used to engineer the curricula for elementary schools. I was born back in the early 1951. That was sort of the ideological cover back then was, you know, you were going to fight communists. But of course, being a male figured in very heavily in that too. You know, sort of being a young man in search of his own masculine identity and that kind of thing also factored into my thinking about that. So it's kind of hard to examine one's own motivations from that far back, but that's not unlike the mixture of motives that are still there for people who are joining the military or thinking about joining the military, especially young men. It's a combination of they find an ideological justification, whether it's the war on communism or the war on terror or whatever it is, and that gives them sort of a moral facade. But there's also something about, you know, wanting to prove their masculinity, and there's the job security. There's never just one reason for somebody to take a decision like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talked about, you know, serving in Vietnam and stuff like that. I'm kind of interested. I mean, there's also, and you talk about this in your book, in Full Spectrum Disorder. You talked about, you know, coming back from Vietnam and this sort of, I guess it was sort of like this, like, oh my God, this is what I was told was not the case. You know, what you just outlined there, you know, this was not the case. Talk about that experience of almost this, I guess, almost like this awakening of, you know, what has been fed to me is not true. Talk about that process in yourself.
Well, it's kind of show up and grow up because you can't conceal the actual nature of the military from the people who are participate in military operations. I was in the infantry, so, you know, I wasn't insulated from that by an office or anything. there's a kind of idealized propaganda out there, especially in a very militaristic culture like the United States. Less so, I think, in Canada, but certainly in the United States, we're an extremely militaristic culture. And Veterans Day is an occasion for us to engage in sort of a collective soldier worship, because we've idealized the military in so many ways. The narrative that underwrites that propaganda is that we are the best of all possible worlds, that there are these dark threats sort of on the outside, and then somewhere beyond that frontier, some brave people have to be willing to go out there and sacrifice among all those dark, scary others in order to preserve, you know, freedom, et cetera, you know, our way of life. And this sacrifice narrative is what makes it so easy to accomplish the apotheosis of soldiers. Because sacrifice is something, the idea of sacrifice is something that goes very deep in Judeo-Christian culture, though it's taken on a new meaning in a militaristic society. It wasn't until the Civil War that we started actually honoring soldiers just because they were soldiers, and that's because it became more convenient to do so, and it was also because the nature of war was changing, and it was becoming so evil in some ways that they had to work a little harder to continue to rationalize it. It was actually during the U.S. Civil War where the concept of general war really came into its own, and from that time forward, you know, war was not just declared on foreign armies, it was declared on entire societies. And so you end up sort of with the progress from then until now to getting people to accept the notion of collateral damage. You know, that this is a necessity. But, you know, again, you know, when you hear people valorize soldiers on Veterans Day during this collective orgy of soldier worship, you'll always hear about sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. And it's always the soldier that sacrifices. And you hear all sorts of, you know, people have almost reflexively learned to justify for themselves, you know, without these soldiers, we wouldn't have our freedom. So the truth of the matter is the United States hasn't been under a foreign threat, not any credible foreign military threat since the War of 1812. So there are multiple forms of self-delusion that are necessary to maintain that militaristic culture. But, you know, as you've alluded to, media representations go a long way because especially electronic and audiovisual media are very, very powerful because they construct a story that's internally self-justifying that then becomes sort of, and they're able to distribute it to the huge numbers of people throughout the society, homogenizing their thinking, and creating something that's really a generalized cultural imaginary, for lack of a better word. And this cultural imaginary is one where soldiers are the front line that separates goodness and order from all that badness and chaos that's out there, that's over there somewhere, that's threatening us all the time. So, you know, the soldiers are cast into the role of saviors, you know, and it's interesting how different that is, especially coming out of a culture that still defines itself as a Christian culture, that, you know, there's this savior who sacrifices himself nonviolently, and it becomes transformed into saviors who sacrifice themselves by killing others. It's interesting how that concept of sacrifice in the service of militarism has been perverted over time. I don't know. Your mention of mass media is really important. It's really important for people to become much more aware, much more, I don't know, capable of sort of conducting their own cultural criticism of films, in particular films and television programs and so forth, because some of these things are very powerful stories. You look at something like Saving Private Ryan, and obviously it's important that that's World War II was the good war because we were fighting Hitler, so it makes it much more difficult to undermine this idea that these people were sacrificing for the greater good. You'd have a much more difficult time getting away with the Saving Private Ryan narrative in Vietnam, for example, or during the war against Mexico, or some of these other past military adventures. But that's mm-hmm. the one that is sort of the easiest for them to hang their hat on. But it's a powerful narrative, and then you have all these. It talks about sacrifice from beginning to end, and sacrifice is a very emotionally resonant idea with people. It signifies for us the capstone of virtue in many ways. The idea that someone would sacrifice themselves for something greater than themselves. And like I say, where that you can go back 2,000 years and find that narrative in a nonviolent context, and you can see how the same narrative has been mapped onto a new context where it's not just the willingness to die for others, but it's the willingness to kill for others that's valorized in the society. So.
Now, in talking about media representations, you're a veteran of Delta Force, of the United States Special Forces, and one of the more popular video games, and I think it's coming out, either it's coming out this week or whatever, is the new Call of Duty Modern Warfare, where someone plays as a Special Forces soldier. I wonder, even in the marketing of that game, there's a commercial I saw where there's a Special Forces guy and some regular kind of dude, and it's kind of they're in the middle of a battle, and the Special Forces guy is kind of showing the regular this regular guy how to fight a war, basically. Throw the grenade there, you gotta lay down suppressing fire here, and then as the commercial goes on, all of a sudden this regular dude is now all of a sudden a soldier, and the tagline is there's a little bit of a warrior in all of us. So I wonder, with that kind of media depiction in these video games, as you as a someone who has actually been there, you have been to Haiti, to Somalia, to Central and South America, what is your response to that kind of stuff, and does it line up with your experience in the Special Forces?
I've had the misfortune of seeing some of these games with my own kids and grandkids. I mean, everywhere. Let's not underestimate the importance of gender in understanding this. This is a male phenomenon, and it is a phenomenon of cultural construction of masculinity that's based on the idea of domination. And that's whether that's domination of women or domination of nature or domination of other men in warfare. It's still all about domination. And so you see that sort of conquest meme again and again. And in these games, what I've noticed about these games, the ones that I have seen, is that they're usually played out on terrain where somehow magically all the civilians have disappeared. In many of them, the one that I remember seeing, there's one that's a reenactment of Stalingrad. They're going through the rubble and they meet nothing but either their allies or their enemies. But the fact is, the world is populated mostly by civilians, and civilians are always there, and they're always part of the equation in actual military operations. In fact, they're the people that soldiers end up dealing with most frequently, and soldiers who are working for an imperial power like the United States, and I say that in a way that I think is operational definable. It's a country that requires a military presence overseas to ensure a flow of materials and resources back into the core, which is definitive of the United States. And the mission of a soldier, for example, in Afghanistan or Iraq, vis-a-vis the civilians, which you never hear about. They always want to talk about combat because this is, you know, some place where they're in a contest where, you know, they can sort of map this good and evil, a contest between good and evil on top of it. But 99 9/10% of the contact that those soldiers have is with civilians. Huh. And their job, when they're in contact with those civilians, is to control those populations. And if those populations resist control for any of the reasons that you or I would resist control if a foreign military were present in our country, or the same reasons that they have for resisting control, but nonetheless, the soldier's obligated by his orders to exercise different forms of population control. So there's a built-in antagonism between the soldier and the entire population. It's a structural antagonism that's built in between him and the entire population of a country. And if that country, or if elements in that country, decide to resist with arms, as they did in Iraq and as they are in Afghanistan and as they did in Vietnam and all sorts of other places, then the ability of the soldier to differentiate between, quote, combatant and, quote, non-combatant, it becomes very difficult to make. It's a very tough distinction to make. And what happens is the soldier comes to hate the entire population because that population, hate is an outgrowth of fear. And they have to fear the entire population in addition to being obliged by their mission to dominate that entire population. I think if someone really wants to understand what soldiery is, what soldiery is most of the time, especially when they're not in combat, is repetitious, boring training and repetitious, boring, tasks and details and a lot of bureaucratic nonsense. So it's not all about, you know, being in an adventure of some kind every day. A lot of it is pretty mundane stuff, you know, like cleaning your barracks room or cutting grass or, you know what I mean, all those kind of things. But in these combat zones where there's not constant combat taking place, I think one of the most important studies that's ever come out that sort of explains that structural antagonism is something called the Stanford Prison Experiment. Mm-hmm. Back in 1971, a guy at Stanford decided to conduct an experiment using role plays. They were vetted sort of middle-class members of the student body. And they put some of them in this role. It was supposed to go on for, I don't know, 2 weeks or a month or whatever, into a mock prison. And then they had other people that played the role of the prison guards. And everybody understood that this was a role play. But they were each of them, you know, trying to live into their roles as much as they could. And the object of the experiment was something totally different than what they discovered from the experiment, which had to be terminated early. It had to be terminated, I think, in less than a week, because within 2 or 3 days, the people who were playing in the role of the prison guards became so over-the-top nasty and cruel and vicious that there was really a chance that somebody's life might be endangered, and so they had to terminate the entire experiment. But what they learned from this was that if you put someone in a role, they will live into that role. If you put a soldier in the role of occupier, then he or she now, in some cases, are in a role where they are obliged by that role to control a population that inherently does not want to be controlled. And so the enemy is not somebody with a gun. The enemy is everybody that lives there, potentially. And then there's a certain process that takes place where people have to overcome the cognitive dissonance about it. It goes back to my experience in Vietnam. I never heard anybody refer to Vietnamese when I was in Vietnam as Vietnamese. They were referred to as dinks and gooks and all sorts of other racial epithets. And that was the language we used, and it was the language that was used all the way up to the general officer level. The same thing with calling Germans Krauts in World War II, or calling, you know, the Iraqis Hajis. you have to, if you're obliged, or if you're potentially obliged, to beat someone down or kill them, or destroy their homes, or to do all sorts of things that you may be obliged to do as a soldier, then the only way you can live with yourself is to strip the people who are the object of your antagonistic intentions of their essential humanity. And you do that sort of in a nutshell by turning them into something that's other than a human. It's not an Iraqi, it's a Haji. It's not a Vietnamese, it's a gook. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
This person does not enjoy the status of human being the same as I do. Otherwise, I would not have the right to come here on land that they occupy and do the things that I do to control this population. And that's the reality of soldiery in situations like that. And that's actually the reality of soldiery in general almost all the time. If you look at the... people want to believe in the United States, we've got this idea in our head that war is sort of an anomalous condition that's brought on by extremity or by the emergence of a threat. But the fact is there's been some sort of an extremity that justified military intervention the majority of the time from since this country was founded. Hmm. Even before we had standing armies, we were constantly having to put together armies of some kind or militias of some kind to go out there and engage in all sorts of operations, depending on, you know, who it was they were engaging in the operations against. It might have been, you know, it might have been Mexicans in order to annex part of Mexico. It might have been, you know, the annexation of the Philippines and Cuba during the Spanish-American War. It might have been, in the case of World War One, it was really about making sure that they tipped the balance back toward the Allies so that they'd be able to pay off their war debts. Mm-hmm. Woodrow Wilson actually campaigned as an anti-war candidate, and then Wall Street compelled him to commit U.S. troops because if the Allies lost, then they wouldn't be able to repay the war debts that had been borrowed from Wall Street. So, but they had to portray that as a condition of extremity. That, you know, it was a fight for democracy. It was a titanic battle between good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you hear Bush saying the same thing about some, you know, cheap thug like Saddam Hussein, that he's that he represents Hitler, that he represents, you know, a challenge to good by evil. You know, it's always framed in those terms. And, but again, there's this propaganda. There's this propaganda element that sort of justifies it so the whole society can sit with it, so that we can kind of sit comfortably back in the suburbs and say that everything's okay because somewhere out there in that danger zone we have this person who's out there prepared to make the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, again, and I really don't think you can, the book that I wrote after Full Spectrum Disorder was Sex and War, and it was about gender and militarism, because the more that I thought about militarism, the more obvious it became to me that construction of masculinity as conquest and domination are probably the more deeply resonant idea that contributes to the perpetuation of militarism in war, which goes way, way back. I mean, you're talking about something about people's sexual identity, especially males, this idea that they have to somehow prove themselves, you know, in ultimately in battle, which is sort of, you know, sort of a pre-Socratic idea.
Another thing that I read in the book Full Spectrum Disorder that I found very interesting. Because, I mean, it's quite obvious, and it'll be quite obvious to listeners when you know, they listening to you speak for the last 20 minutes, you are definitely of the left in a lot of your thinking. But in Full Spectrum Disorder, you talked about how there's a disconnect between both the left and the right in their when they talk about the military, and you talk about this on how the left tends to automatically demonize the soldier. I think you made the point of the so-called sniper in Washington D.C. In the book. So could you talk a bit about that, because I find that very interesting.
Well, yeah, and it's been several years since I published Full Spectrum Disorder, and my own thinking's evolved quite a bit. I certainly wouldn't count myself as any part of the organized left anymore, but mm-hmm. by the same token, I've never counted myself as somebody who's from the right. I'm sort of, I guess, perpendicular to the continuum now.
Okay.
So I'm not sure where I'd fit on it, but...
Fair enough.
And it's become less so, especially with the emergence of, with the emergence of groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War, who become very pivotal actors inside the peace movements now. But there's a sort of a notion that among some people that, in the same way that the right would say that soldiers enjoyed a certain special moral valorization, the left would say the same thing, only in reverse, that they bore a certain special moral censure. But I think that's unfair. It sort of assumes that everybody just emerges from the womb fully conscious of all these issues, as opposed to being imbricated in a culture that drills them in a dominant ideology day in and day out from the time they're born. Soldiers in general are, and it's kind of, this is one of those contradictory intersections, but soldiers in general are not members of the upper class. They're more rural than they are city. They're more poor than they are well-to-do. They usually have slightly, you know, on the low end of high school, they're usually high school graduates as opposed to college graduates. And they are not homogeneous except in the experience that they've had in the military. The military does an effective job of homogenizing people into their culture. I only wish some other communities were as effective as that. But they do homogenize everyone into the culture, that everybody understands, you know, the military vocabulary. They understand how to shoot and salute and do all those other things that they're supposed to do while they're in the military. But it doesn't completely strip them of their individuality, and it doesn't strip them of their capacity for critical thought. The reason that people don't think critically is not that they're in the military or out of the military. It's because critical thought's not valued in this society in general. And, in fact, it's hammered out of us in public schools at the earliest possible opportunity. So I think and what the left didn't see, I think, initially, there was the potential for soldiers. The soldiers are the people, if they don't, you know, if they're not strongly attached to their own rationalizations, soldiers are in a better position than anyone to know how at variance the reality is with the kind of propaganda and and media representations of the military. Soldiers know what it was really like whenever they really participate in operations, and they know how different that is from what's represented in a film or the, you know, the kind of over-the-top language that people use to praise soldiers on Veterans Day. So that means that there's a huge potential for people who are in the military if they find through a process of revelation and critical thought that they want to oppose the military. They really do have a key role to play as witnesses,
mm-hmm.
and that cannot be overstated. Because they're the ones that are in the best position to sort of undermine the dominant narrative that's out there about why the military is so great, and, you know, we're sacrificing for freedom and democracy and all those other things.
Right. Well. Well. Wow. That's 30 minutes has flown right by. Certainly hasn't felt that long. But I think I'm going to end it there. I mean, there's so much more actually to talk about and a lot of the issues you've raised, but we're going to have to end it there, Stan. So thank you very much for giving your time and talking about some of your experiences and your analysis of the military and military life and what it entails, especially on this day, Remembrance Day or Veterans Day, when really this is what it should be about, yet, you know, we don't get that in the media. Now, if the listeners want to get more of your writings and thoughts and analysis, where can they do that?
Oh, I guess they could go to, I share a blog with D. Clark, who was my editor for the book Sex and War. And the blog is called Feral Scholar, mm-hmm. F-E-R-A-L, as in wild, Scholar, S-C-H-O-L-A-R. There's Feral Scholar. We put stuff up on there, and there's a, you know, space for people to comment. I'm not sure. It's kind of all over the map in terms of what people talk about. It doesn't just talk about militarism. I'm trying to escape that as like some singular identity, you know, professional anti-war veteran.
Yeah.
You know, this militarism is part of a larger problem. So that's where we talk about stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Invite people to come by and check it out.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Stan.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, have a good day.
Okay, you too.